All right, ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to What Is. This is lesson number 6, always a bittersweet lesson. It's our 6th and final lesson, but we have saved the best for last. Trust me on this. Today's class is incredible. So they tell a story. There's a couple, a young couple who is engaged to be married, and they step into the rabbi's office. You know, pre-marriage counseling and meetings and going over things. And the rabbi has them fill out a pre-marriage questionnaire. And so the young man is filling out the questionnaire, and he gets up to the question, and the question says, are you entering into this marriage by your own choice and volition, not coerced by any other party? And he pauses, and he ponders, and he looks at it, and he looks at it, and he looks at it, and time passes, and the young lady says to him, aren't you going to write yes already? Aren't you going to write yes already? Write yes, will you? Okay, yeah, there we go. That's a good start to this class, folks. Let's talk about free choice and coercion. So the question on the table, the question on the table is choice real or is it an illusion? Do we really have free choice, or are our choices influenced and determined by forces either outside of ourselves or even inside of ourselves, but forces that we might not be aware of? How free is the choice that we have? How free are our choices? What about God? Does God somehow influence the choices that we make? So in short, the question is free choice really so free, or are our actions determined by a multitude of influences? So today we're going to explore what Judaism has to say about all of this, what Jewish philosophy says, and of course, what Jewish mysticism, the teachings of Kabbalah, have to say about this topic. Okay, good. So again, topic is free choice, real or myth. So I'd like to begin by discussing the power of influence. You see, there are a lot of things that influence us in ways that we don't even know. You and I might be influenced by a whole host of factors that we're not even aware of, and these factors are influencing the decisions that we make. So, in other words, one could argue, and this is a very deterministic point of view, one could argue that our choices are the product of all of the factors and all of the forces, seen and unseen, that are into our lives. So if you took a human being and you plugged in all the stuff inside and all the factors that are inside and all the factors that are outside, family, education, upbringing, nature, tendencies, temperament, all of that stuff, if you plugged everything in, could you theoretically create an algorithm that would accurately, 100%, predict what a person would choose? Some say yes. Some say yes. If you knew everything that was going in, outside and inside, everything that was weighing on the person facing this choice at any given moment, some say if you knew all of those factors, you could quantify them and run them through some sort of machine, computer, you could accurately predict what a person will choose. In fact, if you think it's far-fetched, you should know this. There are people that make their living off of this. People that make a lot of money and make themselves very vulnerable, and they are banking on their ability to influence someone to make a decision to their liking. Who am I thinking of?
Advertisers.
Huh?
Advertisers.
Advertisers. What else?
Lobbyists.
Speculators.
Lobbyists.
Lobbyists. Actuaries. Who else? You guys are not... I'm trying to influence you and you're not being influenced by my suggestions here. Who am I thinking of?
Rabbis.
Yeah, what else? Yes, also. But rabbi is not working, so this rabbi is not figuring out the crowd. Okay, I'm thinking about mentalists. Has anybody ever seen a mentalist?
No, there's a show.
It's all a joke.
One second. Okay, so that could be true also. But there are some people that are very talented at influencing what other people think. In other words, they'll say, for example, pick a number, and the way they ask the question influences the number that you're going to choose, and therefore they can guess what you're choosing, because what you're choosing is not really what you're choosing. It's how you're being influenced to choose that thing. Does this make sense? You guys want to see a real example of this? I'm sure you do. I'm not even waiting for any answers. Okay, so here's the lesson video. Oh, you guys can fight it out. Ooh, Adira's a little quicker on the draw over there. Okay, and hold on. Trying to figure out why this is blank. Hold on, folks. Wait, please. This was up a second ago, wasn't it? The music was, yeah. Okay, hold on. We're going to get this. It's going to be good. And here we go. Lesson video. This should work. Let's see.
Our path in life? Sure, it feels like we make choices. This is how we experience life. It feels like we decided what to eat for lunch today. It feels like we decided what career to pursue, whom to marry, and so on. But do we really choose? Or perhaps every choice we make is determined by forces that lie beyond our control, or even outside of our awareness? Is our free choice nothing more than an illusion?
And I'm here with mentalist Mark Salem.
Mark Salem is his name.
Mark Salem is the incredible mind reader.
Mark Salem is a mentalist, meaning that he has an uncanny ability to know what people are thinking, and also to somehow communicate to people what to think. We asked Mark to address our class via video and demonstrate to us that often we think that we are making a choice, but really we aren't. Focus closely on Mark as he addresses us through the video screen.
Let us take these numbers, 1 to 4. I'm going to try to project a number 1 to 4 to your mind. We'll see how successful I am. The number that I was projecting was the number 3.
How many of you chose the number 3? Now, if that seemed a bit easy, after all, Mark had a 25% chance of getting it right. Mark has another trick up his sleeve.
Now, I'm thinking of a 2-digit number. Both digits are odd. Both digits odd. And not the same. Not like 11. 2-digit number. Both digits odd. Between 0 and 50. Both digits odd, not the same. This is the number I'm trying to project to you.
In closing, we will show Mark demonstrating his skill on a much bigger crowd, but in a way that allows us all to participate as well. Join the exercise as if you are in Mark's audience.
Mark has taken over Times Square to attempt a massive mind melt and prove his super success is the real deal.
We're going to use what are called Zener cards, or sometimes ESP cards. It's a number of different shapes. One is a star. One is a circle. One is a square. We have the wavy lines. And the last one is a plus sign.
Take a look at these 5 cards again. A star, a circle, a square, we have the wavy lines, and a plus sign.
Now I want you all to concentrate on the card that reaches you the deepest. And I'm going to try to see which one you're sending me.
Free choice is sometimes an illusion.
Okay. Okay, by raise of hands. By raise of hands. Who did he... Did he get... By raise of... Did he... how do I phrase the question?
How many times did he get...
Not you don't even have time. If he got what you were thinking once, even once, raise your hand.
Once.
Oh wow, that's not bad. That's not bad. Okay.
Once.
Which one? The wavy lines.
The wavy lines.
The wavy lines.
And 37.
And you got 37? That's impressive. That's impressive. Okay. All right. So how does it work? He's not reading minds. That's not a thing. He's influencing. So Nussin tells me Mark Salem visited his camp up in Montreal 5 times. Every year, apparently, he visits. And he told them the trick of 1 to 4, how that works. You see, he writes 4 numbers down, and then he centers the 3 right under his nose. And he says, 1, 2, 4. Pick a number of 1, 2, 4. The only one that's not mentioned, of course, is the number 3. So that's subtly the number that you're going to choose is one maybe that wasn't mentioned, etc. So there are clues, there are things that he does to influence. Star, square, plus line, plus sign, and the wavy lines. There's a different way in how he's expressing the wavy lines. It's the more interesting or unique one. There are certain things that stick out. Odd numbers, it can't be 11. We immediately go to the 3, but it can't be a double, so it can't be 33. Whatever his formula is, and it doesn't work obviously 100% of the time, it works more, I think, if those that are more open to being suggested to, it works better. But the point is like this. He's made a career of wowing audiences, and he banks on this. He literally cashes in on this, of his ability to subtly influence what you decide. He's not telling you to choose 37, but he kind of is. He's not telling you to choose the wavy lines, but he kind of is also, right? So there's ways to influence and be influenced in a subtle way. Some argue, therefore, that there's no such thing as free choice. We're always being influenced. And the choice that we think is free is really the product of any number of influences that are affecting us. What does Judaism say about this? Let's jump in right away to text number 1. Howard, please read page 208, text number 1. This is a verse from Deuteronomy, from Devarim. So God says, look, I have placed before you, I've set before you on this day. Actually, it's Moses speaking. But the point is that God places before us life and good, death and evil. Uvacharta b'chaim, and you shall choose life. What does this tell us? What do you learn from this text?
Do what you're told.
Do we have free choice or we don't have free choice?
No.
We do.
No.
Why do you say no?
Because he told us what to do.
He's suggesting that we choose life, but the word choose implies, indeed, that there's a choice. In fact, Maimonides, in other words, what I'm trying to say is like this. Let's take a step back. The world has a discussion and debate whether free choice is real or not. The question is, what does Judaism have to say about it? The Torah says, choose. You have 2 paths in front of you. Every single person has 2 paths, good, evil, life, death. Choose life. It's your choice. Maimonides, Rambam, hold on 1 second, take a look at Rambam. Lolly, please read text number 209. This is an absolutely critical text. It comes from Mishneh Torah, the massive compendium of Jewish law that Maimonides wrote, 14 volumes. Hilchot Shuvah, Laws of Repentance, chapter 5. He talks about, the whole chapter is about free choice. Here are excerpts from the first 4 halachot that talk about free choice.
Freedom of choice has been granted to every person. If a person wants to turn to the path of good and be righteous, the choice is theirs. And if a person wants to turn to the path of evil and be wicked, the choice is theirs. This concept is a fundamental principle and a pillar of the Torah and its commandments. And it is written, see, I have given before you this day life and good and death and evil. Were God to decree that a person should be righteous or wicked, or if there were to be something in a person's primary nature that would compel them toward a particular path, a particular conviction, a particular character trait, or a particular deed, how could God command us through prophets, do this and do not do this? What place would the entire Torah have? And by what measure of justice would God punish the wicked and reward the righteous?
Thank you. So let's unpack this reading. So Maimonides teaches us that in the Jewish understanding, free choice is 100% real. It's not fake. It's not an illusion. It's 100% real. And he cites, by the way, in one of the excerpts here that was dotted out, so it's not cited here, he cites a verse from Genesis where God says, the human being is unique and alone in that the human being is the only creature that knows the difference between right and wrong. This is after the sin of the tree of knowledge of good and evil, the tree of knowledge of right and wrong. So God says, Hein Adam, indeed the human being is now the knower of right and wrong, good and evil. Maimonides says, what does this mean that the human being knows the difference between right and wrong? Knows the difference and has the ability to choose between that which he or she knows to be right or wrong. Again, free choice is a foundational idea to Judaism, without which Rambam says, get rid of the prophets, get rid of the Torah, get rid of reward and punishment. The whole Judaism collapses without free choice. Why? It's simple. If you and I don't have the choice, so why are we being told what to do? God says, I want you to do this, but I can't. I'm being compelled in a different direction. So now what? What's the point of Torah telling us, do this, don't do that, if a person could always say, it's not my fault, I didn't choose, I've been influenced. In other words, for a person to say that it wasn't my choice is to negate the validity and the basis of the entire Torah. The prophets come along and say, God says, do this and don't do that. Be careful if you don't listen. You know, gloom and doom. What's the point of the prophets? We can't do otherwise, so why tell us? Reward and punishment. Who are you rewarding and who are you punishing? If all choices are compelled, if our behavior is compelled, we had to do this and we couldn't have done that, so why reward good behavior? We were compelled to do it anyway. Why punish bad behavior? We were compelled to do that anyway. Not only, does this make sense? Not only does Judaism collapse, any legal system collapses in the face of compulsion and determinism. Understand what I'm saying? Somebody says to the officer that pulls them over after running a red light, I understand that in the books of law, it talks about stopping at red lights, but I am forced, compelled by factors inside and outside me to run red lights. If that was acceptable, right? What does the cop say?
Compelled to the judge.
Huh?
I'm compelled by factors to arrest
you. Right. And it doesn't matter what factors you think or you don't think you have, make a different choice. Make a better choice. Make a more just and legal choice. So the point is, the law does not take into account, no legal system, I would say forget about Torah, we're not going to forget about Torah, but aside from Torah, any legal system, any moral system, any value system does not take determinism into account. Because otherwise, all of these systems would collapse, be irrelevant. Well, all right, we're going to leave politics out of it. But understand this, the point is that every system collapses if you take choice away from people. If you take choice away from people, so why are you telling me what to do and what not to do? It's falling on deaf ears. I can't do it anyway, or I have to do it anyway. Okay, so Maimonides says, the fact that we have Torah, that God tells us, do this, don't do that. The fact that we have prophets like Moses. The fact that we have reward and punishment stated in Torah. If you do this, you get this reward. If you do that, be careful. The fact that we have all of this evidence in Torah, or all of the pieces of Torah, all of this points to the irrefutable fact that according to Judaism, human beings have free choice. So what do you do? What do you do with the question that we had before? The question that we had before is basically, it seems like there are a lot of factors in our lives, inside and outside, that do influence us. And it seems like sometimes we feel like we can't choose. Like, I would like to make the right choice, but I can't. Whatever it is, right? So a lot of times, a person might feel that they are being influenced. Or Mark Salem might tell a person, hey, I'm influencing you. So what do we do about that? So take a look at a contemporary of Rambam, a contemporary of Maimonides, the Ravid, whose name was, that's what he's known as, an acronym. His name is Rabbi Avram ben David. So here's what he writes, text number 3. Incredible text. This is very important to the doctrine of free choice. Anastasia, please read.
As is known, everything that happens to a person, whether a major event or a minor one, the Creator placed in the hands of the constellations. However, God gave a person a mind that is empowered to overcome the influence of the constellations. This is the power given to a person to be good or bad.
So the thank you. The Ravid says, look, the stars have power. Star power. That's a different power. Right? The constellation, the zodiac, the mazalot. Right? Astrology. By the way, if you want a great series on Jewish astrology, a great video series on Jewish astrology, just go to TorahCafe.com, look for astrology. You may or may not see 12 videos that I made for TorahCafe.com on each of the astrological signs, plus a few more about astrology in general. It's a great topic, but there are videos that I've recorded for it, hours long. You can take a look and enjoy. However, the point of this is like this. When it feels like you might be influenced, and you are being influenced, the Ravid says that Judaism believes that you have the opportunity to rise above the influence. Even if you're influenced, you're not being compelled. There's a difference between influence and compulsion, and it's not the same. So we can be influenced by our nature. We can be influenced by our nurture. We can be influenced by Mark Salem. You saw him with the kippah there? You saw him standing in the video that was the video of the video being shot? Did you see that? That was, next to him was the course author, Rabbi Yankee Tauber, who's incredible mind. Anyway, so...
We don't go to psychics, because even though we do have a prediction in the stars, we can go beyond it.
Yes, exactly. So Judaism believes, right. So in short, the stars influence us, but there's no point, I'm going to use a Yiddish word, kaching, that means cooking. It means like getting all heated up about the stars, about those influences. At the end of the day, if it's not good, we can change it. If it is good, we can't rest in our laurels. We still have to make it happen. In other words, nothing is automatic. So whether it's bad, whether it's good, you still have to make it happen. So who cares what they say? Make it happen anyway. They, I mean the stars. Right? So that's the point. The point is that it's the effort anyway. So getting back to this point, Judaism says, yes, of course there are factors that influence us. Yes, inside factors, your personality, your tendencies, right? Your physical, emotional, and mental capacities, etc. There are outside influences, but none of them compel you definitively to behave a certain way. They might influence you, but it's not forcing you. And a person has a mind that is empowered to overcome the influence, he says, of the constellations, and I'm saying of anything. Now, the Talmud says in text number 4, dear, please read this, page 210, the Talmud says gives a fascinating example of this that I think you all will like.
One who is born under the influence of Mars, the god of war, will be a person who sheds blood, said Ravashi, either surgeon, or a robber, or a butcher, or a mohel.
Yeah, a circumciser. So look at what the Talmud says. If you're born under Mars, Mazal Madim, so now it's red. It's a red planet, right? Yes? Yes? So Mars means blood. There's blood in your future. That's your influence. Your influence is bloodshed. So does that mean they have to be a violent person? No. They could be a surgeon. They could be a robber. Oy. Eigevalt. They could be a butcher. Less Eigevalt, right? A moil. Mazel tov. Right? So there are different ways in which a person could channel or express that the red tendency, so to speak. Okay? Make sense? So again, you're being influenced? Fine. But how do you choose? How do you channel it? That is ultimately up to the individual. It's interesting. So... unrelated, but obviously related, because everything's related, and specifically this example. So there's a teaching. There's a teaching from the Maggid of Mizrich, the second in the dynasty of Hasidic masters, the Baal Shem Tov, the Maggid. The next generation, we had the Alter Rebbe, the founder of Chabad. But in the general Hasidic movement, he was the second generation, the Maggid of Mizrich. Maggid of Mizrich taught that the 42 masaot, the 42 travels of the Jewish people in the wilderness between Egypt and the Holy Land, are 42 journeys that every single human being endures in life. From the moment they exit the womb, which is the exodus, right? From place of constraint into the open to freedom, that's birth. The last is entering the land of Israel, that is passing over, crossing over to the other side. Between those two journeys, so there's 40, I guess 40, 41, whatever it is, the journeys in between. Everyone goes through all of these journeys, all 42 journeys. By the way, Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, yes, 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 yes. What's the number? Okay, now, okay, maybe it's a coincidence, maybe it's not. I don't know how well versed they are in the Bible, but that's definitely a thing. Now, The Rebbe asked the following question. Amongst the journeys of the Jewish people were, calamitous? Calamitous? Is that right? Calamitous journeys. Journeys that ended in calamity. That's an easier way to say it. Right? They ended up in tragedy and disaster. They made mistakes, they sinned, and many of them died in a plague that God sent. For example, Kivrot HaTaiva, we just read about it last week. That's the place, it's literally called the burial place of those who had desire. Kivrot HaTaiva, where desire was buried. When the Jews desired meat, and God said, you want meat? Yeah, we really want meat. So he sent the quail. The meat was still between, the flesh was still between their teeth, they were eating the meat, and God sent down a plague to those people that were complaining and were grabbing the meat. And there they were buried. And it's called Kivrot HaTaiva, where those that had desire, those that craved, the craven ones, were buried. So the Rebbe asks, so everyone has to go through that? If everyone has to go through all 42 journeys, that means that everyone is foretold, everyone is designated to have disaster and tragedy in their life. What does that mean? And the Rebbe says, no. Everyone is destined to be tempted with cravings. And then there are two options. Either you give into it and you're buried by it, or you conquer it and you bury the actual temptation. You with me? You're either buried by the temptation, or you bury the temptation. Kivrot HaTaiva can mean also the place where temptation was buried, was overcome. The influences will be there, but the choices that we make in those moments, Judaism believes, are ours. And if we so choose, we have the ability to overcome even those influences that are very strong. Now, so all of that, all of that addresses the first question that we have, which is the Mark Salem question. Is free choice real if we can be influenced by other factors? And the answer is yes. Influence is influence, but it's not compulsion. The bigger question is, and this is the question that everyone asks, and the big question that everyone asks, and why do I say everyone asks? Because I've been asked this question over the last 10 years. I've been asked it dozens of times. So I'm just going to put everyone into this. Everyone asks this question. You've asked this question. If you say to me, you've never asked this question, don't worry, you asked this question, you just forgot. Everyone asks this question. And the question is, if, help me out here, you guys say it along with me, if God knows,
if God knows what we're going to do,
everything, even what I'm going to do tomorrow or the next minute, so how do I have free choice? In other words, if God knows what I will choose tomorrow, do I have a choice to do the opposite? Yes or no?
Yes. No.
Wait a second. Do I have the opposite? One second. I have the opposite. I have the choice. I have, okay. Can I do the opposite of what God knows that I'm going to do tomorrow?
Yes.
No. But then God doesn't know it.
Well,
that doesn't count. If God is, God knows what I'm going to do, that sounds like Vegas. Like I know the Golden Knights. Any hockey fans here? It doesn't matter anymore. I know the gold. Okay. Wow, I got to use a better example. I know the Golden Knights are going to win the Stanley Cup in 5 games, except the fact that they're now down 3-1, and so that's not going to happen, right? So that's not how God operates. In other words, if I can choose tomorrow or now to do something different than what God knows, so that gives me choice, but that gives God, that takes away the absolute knowledge of God. Okay. If God's knowledge is so absolute that there's no way that I can do anything other than what he knows I'm going to do, well then, that takes away my choice. Comes the next moment, God knows. Okay, so there's two levers. Lever one and lever two. Right? One, two. Which lever am I going to pull? Now there's a third option. None. Or fourth option. Both. But those are not options. Off the table. So which lever? One or two? I have to pull one. One or two. One or two. So let's say God knows I'm going to pull one. Can I pull two?
You can.
I can, but then God's knowledge is flawed. Right? So then God doesn't really know. God thought he knew, but again, I also thought I knew when I put down a lot of money on the Golden Knights, which I didn't, but I could have, but I didn't. right? And God is losing the bet. So God says, I know you're going to pull one. And then we're like, yeah, look at that, I pulled two. And God's like, oh, every time that guy gets me. That can't be the case because God's knowledge is not flawed. So then the opposite, we have to say the opposite is true, that God knows that I'm going to pull one. Therefore, I will inevitably pull one. And then the question is, in the moment now, lever one, lever two, if I can't pull two, then where is my free choice? How does this work? This is not my question, and it's not your question. It's also your question. It's also my question. It's an age-old question. In fact, Rabbi Akiva, in Pirkei Avot, in Ethics of the Fathers, Rabbi Akiva, the great Rabbi Akiva, who lived 2,000 years ago, murdered by the Romans for his teaching Torah. So Rabbi Akiva cites this paradox, this conundrum, this question, and he throws it out so casually. Text number 5, Alex.
All is foreseen.
That's how he addresses the paradox. He's like, by the way, in case you're wondering, yes and yes. But how? Yes, that also. Yeah, all is foreseen. God knows everything. And freedom of choice is granted. How does it make sense? I got to run over to the next mission. Sorry, guys. Rabbi Akiva's like, got to run. Got the next class. Right? He's not answering the question. What he's telling us unequivocally is both items are true. Now, we have to pick up the pieces and try to figure this out. Or we don't have to, but then that's what we're here for. So we're going to try to figure this out. How is it possible to have these two statements in very close proximity with a connecting letter and word, and, vav, and? How does that make sense? God knows everything, and yet I can choose whatever I want. If he knows, how do I make a choice? And if I make a choice, how does he know? Karen. One second. I like that answer. What is your degree of certainty with the child that the child will choose the, what were the options again?
Cartoon.
The cartoons over the news. What's the degree of certainty? Give me a percentage.
99.
Are you ready to say 100? I'm right with you. Up to the, I'm willing to go 99.9. But can you really say 100%? And can you say, therefore, that God's knowledge is 99.9%? If it's up to the human being, we are wild cards. Right? Especially what we just explained. That despite the influence, we can pull the other lever at the last minute.
If that were the case, though, if you're the robber, you would lose all hope that you can
rebuild it. If what? If God knew for certain, or if you couldn't? Yeah. You with me on this? It can't be 99%. God's knowledge, if it's really God and it's really knowledge, it has to be 100%. All is foreseen doesn't mean God more or less knows our nature, like we know our kids, and therefore it's like, yeah, he's probably going to do that. It's 100%. If it's 100%, then how do we have free choice? And if we have free choice, how's that 100%? One second. Joy.
Well, my point is that if you look in other places, for instance, in the Psalms, where it talks about where we have been made, Hashem knew us in our mother's womb,
yeah.
He made us, he knows all about us. If you subscribe to the theory that God is omniscient, which is
yes.
The general theory we subscribe to, so the theory would go, he knows us so well that when he made us, and since he has all knowledge, so he knows each variant, all the things you were talking about at the beginning
right.
of the class, all the multiple factors that we are aware of and some we're not aware of, that predictive model, he's 100%.
But I'm asked, but the problem, I'm with you. The problem with that is, then the conclusion of that is, we don't really have free choice. We think we have free choice. We imagine we have free choice. We're unaware of the fact that we don't have free choice, but we really don't have free choice. That's what it means. If we can't choose freely, this one or this one, if there's something that's pushing us in one direction or the other, then you cannot say, Rishus Nesuna, that that free choice is granted. How do you have punishment? If God knows all of the factors and the forces, so how are you punishing the wicked? And how are you rewarding the righteous? And why tell a person, you have to do this? What do you want from me? You know me. You know I can't. So what are you doing? You're just trying to torture me. It's not fair. It's not nice. It's not nice for God to do that. If I can't, so what's God saying? So what's the point? It has to be that no matter all of the algorithms, no matter all the formulas, I can still at any moment freely choose. If I truly decide, if I relinquish my choice, fine. But if I choose to choose, I can choose something radically different than even where I'm programmed.
But does not part of that knowledge include the fact that you can be, let's call it the wild card, and absolutely, for instance, surprise God and do the 0.001% thing that he thought was probability or what?
Yeah, but then God doesn't know. Again, it's does God, how do we have this, the absolute ironclad knowing and the unknowing, Danielle? Are you saying that's what he knows? He knows the options.
He knows the options, and I still have a free will to decide which of the options I'm going to go, but he knows what the path is going to be in the decision of the domino effect.
I will tell you, that's an interesting angle. That's not typically the way it's understood, that's not typically the way that this idea that God knows all is understood. Not that God knows what the outcome would be based on the options that we have in front of us, but rather that God actually knows what it is that we will decide and choose.
Hashem is outside of time. So while we don't know the future, it's a memory. So we still have the choice, but to Hashem, it's nothing but a past memory. It's history to him.
Good. Hold that idea. We're going to get to it in a second. Yeah.
Yeah. So based on my recollection as well, God recreates the world every moment.
Yes.
So basically, it means that I believe we have first the choice to choose,
right?
Freedom of choice, and based on our choice, God recreates the.
Interesting. Okay. Okay. You know, I hear that. Good. I like it.
I think what you said was what I was thinking about. That's why we're in the image of God. We have the choice to create, and. We may not get it right the first time, but there's other.
We hope to have some more opportunities.
At least in the time of God.
Got it. Okay. Sure. Yeah.
All of this conversation anthropomorphizes God.
Okay.
It makes God in man's image. It makes God's knowledge in the terms that we understand it, and that's not necessarily true.
Good.
And therefore, makes the argument moot.
Good. Do you have another model to propose, or you just don't like this model? Right. So forget it. So how does God know? He knows how he knows. I don't know how he knows. If I knew him, I would be him. I don't need to know how he knows. All I know is that I have a choice at any given moment. How God knows what he knows, that's irrelevant. Let him figure that out.
Rabbi Akiva said so. All is foreseen and free choice is great.
Good. So we don't have to get involved in that. Fine. Okay, good. Yeah. One more, and then I'm going to jump back into Maimonides, because he says kind of along the lines of what you're saying. Yeah. Good.
We are given the opportunity to either destroy or continue the creative process of health, growth.
Right.
I also have been told that if there weren't angels stopping us from tripping and hitting our head on the concrete every 5 seconds, none of us would be alive right now. So there is some interference just to keep us. I'll look up while we're texting to swerve or break at the exact same time.
Not that we should be texting while driving. This is not ever. We're so into communication, we can't stop doing it.
We'd rather communicate from this plane and not the other. Right. But the fact that God does see all the options, God does see all the choices, and that in the future, since God already knows something, and I think I'm cheating because I actually attend your classes and I remember what we talk about, that just because God knows what's going to happen in the future, it doesn't take away, because his knowledge is not affecting he knows, but he.
Good. So you're agreeing with Adira. Excellent. Okay, we have a few different camps here, and it's very interesting because we'll see different approaches. That classic Rishonim, the classic Jewish authorities and commentaries and scholars and rabbis take. Let's begin with the first approach. This is the approach of Maimonides. So, Susan, please start us off with this. Wait, hold on. Alex, you read, right? Did you read? Okay, yeah, Susan. Well, it's okay. Susan, it's all you. 200, that's great. 212, listen, we don't discriminate. You get what you get. 212, text number 6. This is how Maimonides articulates the question. Look how he writes it, because he's also going to answer it in a moment in his way. So text number 6. So if God knows it for sure, then you didn't choose. If he doesn't know for sure, then he didn't know for sure. How are both true? Here we go. Maimonides' approach, text number 7. I want you to pay attention. Text number 7 is not easy, but it's important. And as we read text number 7, I want you to think about how is he addressing the question, what is Rambam? What is Maimonides saying? Ilana, please read. Jerry, you feel vindicated?
Yeah, we'll find out.
So far? Yeah. How would you... Okay, this is a question open to everybody. Very quickly, how do you characterize Maimonides' response to the question that he asked? How is it possible that God knows and yet I have choice? What is his answer? In short.
It depends on what knows means. How do you define knows?
That's a very... Yeah, it's a... Okay. It depends on what is. Right, it depends on what knows is. Okay? Yes.
I think we always have a choice because that's what teshuva is.
Right. And these are the Hilchot Teshuva. That's exactly what he's writing in Hilchot Teshuva. So, right, that's his whole premise of this, is that we always have a chance to fix our ways, to change our direction, no matter what. And that's how he concludes. We always have. But how does he address the question? God's knowledge, foreknowledge, versus our free choice. What is he saying?
We are not able to comprehend God.
Good.
Period. Right. The end.
Right?
And by equating, well, with God. No, it's ridiculous. It's
our minds are not like his mind. Because we all agree that this is basically what he's saying. He spends a long time. There's a lot of text, a lot of lines there of Rambam. Maimonides telling us God's mind is not like our mind. It's different. Our mind is different. God's mind, God and his mind are one. We can't understand this, but our minds are not one with us. It's separate from us. So we can't understand God's mind. We can't understand God's ways. We can't understand how God understands, knows what we... Are you with me on this? Yes? There's a lot of preamble in talking about how we can't understand God, and therefore it seems like, right, it seems like what he's saying is simply the answer to this question we will never know. Only God knows, because we are not God. Right? Does this seem like what he's saying?
Yeah.
Few questions. Number one, are you satisfied with this answer?
Yes.
Is this an answer?
Yes.
Okay. Okay. All right. You know who wasn't satisfied with this answer? The Ravid. Rabbi Avraham ben David. You should know that he wrote glosses. I don't know. You know what glosses are? Yeah, it's like you.
Shoddy stuff that you.
These? Right? Glosses?
Glosses.
Pour you a glosses of. No. Glosses are hagahot. They're notes. So the way of classic commentary sometimes was that not everyone would write their own book. You see, some people would just write comments on someone else's book. So my Rambam wrote 14 volumes, thousands of pages of Jewish law. The Ravid, he wrote notes on Maimonides, dissenting notes. I disagree here. Hundreds of times he wrote, I beg to differ. Sometimes he didn't beg. He's like, I differ. In fact, he writes sometimes, I don't know what he's thinking, but this is what all the sources say. I have no idea where he got Maimonides, Rambam got his information from, but here are the sources and this is the way it is. And it's printed in basically pretty much most every edition of Mishneh Torah will be printed along with the Ravid's notes. Sometimes it's indented in the thing in smaller text. It's right there. I wish I had a copy of that to show you. The Ravid's glosses, his notes on Rambam. So he didn't write his own book. He wrote other books. He didn't write his own book on this. He just wrote commentaries on Maimonides' works. You should know that the Ravid took issue with this answer of Rambam. And before Yaakov, I'll get to you in a second. But let's see what Ravid asks on Maimonides. Text number 8. Ray, please read this. But that was his name. He starts off by saying, Amar Avram, Aleph, stands acronym, Amar Avram. Basically, these are my notes. And continue.
The author did not act in the manner of the wise, as one ought not to begin something that one is incapable of concluding. He begins by posing a difficult question, then remains with the difficulty, and reverts to faith. It would have been better
What's Ravid saying in essence? Yeah, if there's no answer, if the answer is well, we don't know, then why are you raising the question? Now you have the question. In other words, the question is stronger than the answer. And now what you've done by asking a question stronger than the answer is now you've populated people's minds, the reader's minds, with a bunch of questions. It's like, oh, now I really don't know. How does this work? How do I have free choice? And now a person is going to question their own free choice. Am I really free to choose, or am I being compelled? Because God knows. And what's Rambam's answer? Rambam pointedly, like, beautifully asked the question. If he knows I'm going to be righteous, and I have to be righteous, then I'm compelled. And if I don't have to be righteous, I could be wicked, then God doesn't know. So how does it work? He articulates the question. And his response is, what's he saying? We don't know. We have no answer. But believe it anyway. Right. We have no idea. Our mind's not like God. But this we know, he ends up. But this we know. That we have the free choice to choose whatever we want at any given moment. This we know. How do we know it now? Now I'm confused. So the Ravid says he was not acting like a chacham, like a wise person.
He was acting like a philosopher.
So the Ravid says, what are you doing? Who does this? Like, why are you asking questions that you're not answering? Now, that's question number one. Question number one. I have more questions. Question number two. If Maimonides is simply saying that we can't understand the ways of God and how God knows, why the elaboration? You notice how long-winded that point was? He says, we've already explained, he quotes himself. We've already explained in Hilchot Yesod HaTorah, the laws of Torah's foundations, that God does not know with a mind that is distinct from his being, as is the case of a human being whose being and mind are two distinct entities. Why are we talking about being versus mind being distinct? Or why is this relevant? Rather, God, I'm back in text number 7, so you don't have to look at it, you just listen to my storytelling. Rather, God and his mind are one and the same, a concept that's impossible for human mind to fully comprehend. What's this whole elaboration? A whole paragraph? A whole section? Just to tell us that we can't understand God? I just said it. Look at that. Look how easy that was. We can't understand God. Done. He could have just said, even though this seems like a paradox, God's knowledge and our choice, you should know that we can't understand God's ways, therefore, we don't have a good answer. He could have just said that. There's a whole long-winded setup before he gets to the fact that we don't know. Why? Okay. He charges by the word. All right. Yeah, exactly. So that's the rivet. If it ain't broke, don't fix it. I always love that line. I heard it in the North, I must confess. It was really, I love that. I love that line. I believe I was working on a model something. Remember those models, you know, something, gluing something. And it was like I was trying to overdo something and it broke. And it's like, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. And that was, yeah. If it ain't broke, don't fix it. Because if you fix it, now it's broke. Okay, so now let's jump into, you should know, so Ravid has a problem with Rambam, with Maimonides. Why is he asking a question and leaving it unanswered? So the Ravid offers his own answer. The Ravid offers his own answer to this great paradox of God's knowledge and free choice. Debbie, please read this one. Text number 9, the Ravid, page 216. Here we go. Okay, so here we go. Let's jump into this. Let's understand the fortune teller approach. Fortune teller approach. Now, there are different ways to understand the Ravid. I'm going to tell you the classic way of understanding the Ravid. You may not have picked this up immediately, but trust me on this. This is the classic way of understanding the Ravid. Let's jump in. The Ravid, everyone with me so far on the characters here in the story? So we have the question. It's the question everyone asks. Maimonides articulates it, doesn't answer it. Ravid says, why are you asking it and not answering it? Don't ask it. He says, well, now that it's asked, here's my answer. And his answer is the fortune teller model, fortune teller approach. What is that? Okay. Ready for this? I'm sure you are. Okay. So imagine, the premise of this approach is that the opposite, here, do it with me, word association, fill in the blanks. The opposite, the antonym, the opposite of choice is
compulsion.
Is the opposite of choice knowledge?
No.
Why not? Because knowledge does not imply power. Are you with me? Or compulsion? Yes, 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 yes. Okay, I know that I still know that that was going to drop. Did my knowledge make it happen?
No, it just happened.
You with me on this? Mm-hmm. In other words, again, the opposite of choice is compulsion. No, it's not knowledge. The opposite of choice is not knowledge because knowledge doesn't equal compulsion. Does this make sense?
Yes.
Yes. I can know, without a shadow of a doubt, that the force of gravity will act on something 10 out of 10 times. That doesn't mean that my knowledge is making it happen. I just happen to know what will happen. I'll give you, yes, yes, with me on this? Knowledge doesn't make it happen. Knowledge is knowing that it will happen or that it did happen. Here's another example. I watched the Super Bowl live and you didn't. And the next day, they're doing a replay of the Super Bowl. Okay? I know who's going to win. I know who's going to score a touchdown. You don't know who's going to win. You don't know who's going to score. Okay? We're watching it together. Nassim, can you close the door? No. Lights on?
Oh, but I like the light on.
We're synced up like this. After 14 years? Thank you. Perfect. Okay, so again, so here's my example. So we're watching a recap of the Super Bowl. Yes? We're watching a recap of the Super Bowl. I saw it live. You didn't see it live. We're watching it together. We're spending quality time together. Okay? I know that the next play that's going to happen is Foles. What's his name? Nick? Nick Foles. What did he do? He faked the spike? What did he do? Oh, he called the Philly play. But what do you do? What do you practice? He faked the direct snap, and he went out to catch a pass. I know that the next play is going to be the Philly, right? Which was the Philadelphia Eagles, which was the trick play that Nick Foles got the touchdown that totally swung the game, and that was it. Okay? So I know that's going to happen next. I saw it yesterday, and I've been Googling it and YouTubing it ever since nonstop. I know it's literally the next play. You have no idea it's going to happen. Okay? You with me? Yes? Yes, yes, yes? Okay. Okay. Good, good, good. Does my knowledge of the play make Nick Foles do that play?
No, absolutely not.
Okay, now I understand.
Why? Because that already happened. Correct. I know it, not because I... How do I know it? Because I seen it. I didn't make it. It was made. I know about it. Now, to you, if you don't know that it's the replay of the Super Bowl, let's say you think it's live. So you think now I'm a fortune teller, which is cool because I could probably cash in on some, what do they call them, those bets, the side bets, the prop bets. I can cash in on some prop bets probably pretty handily, okay, if you don't know when it actually originally aired. Nonetheless, I'm an honest guy, so I'm not going to do that. However, you will think that I am some sort of prophet. Right, that I'm some sort of prophet that knows somehow the future and can foretell things. But here's the deal. I don't know the future. I actually know the past because I've seen it. Remember lesson two? Remember the flipbook example? You actually have it in front of you still. You have that flipbook. How's this character? Probably aging at this point. We're toward the end of the book. Right? So there are our little character is aging. We said before that we are stuck in the flipbook and it's being recreated every moment, as Anastasia reminded us. But the bottom line is we're in the flipbook. Right, and it's moving one direction typically, not the band. It's moving in one direction forward and that's it. Now, here's the thing. God is standing outside the whole construct of the notebook. Not even the notebook, the flipbook. God is standing outside the flipbook. God sees the whole flipbook. Haya, hoveh, v'yeh, ka'echad. God is past, present, future is one. God is beyond time, beyond the constraints. All of time, the constraints of time. The entire span of time, no matter how long it stretches, right? All of that is in the, we had a text from the, I think the Samat Sadek, who said it's all considered to be the continual present before God. To God, it's all in the present, even the future. Huh? Time stands still and God is outside of time, so God sees the whole thing, which means, this is not something we can understand. It's not something that we can relate to in a very, you know, direct way. It's more indirect. But here's the point. What we do know is that God is beyond time. And to God, what to us is the future and the unwritten blank future. To God is the written past. You with me? Because otherwise, God's stuck in the same continuum of time that we are, and we can't do that to God. God chooses also to be involved with time, which we said, but God is not stuck solely in the dimension of time. God also exists outside of time. Remember, I hate to drudge up old lesson twos, but hey, I'll do it on occasion when I need to. So the point is, give me a second, let me just round it out, and I'll get right back to you. So the point is like this. To God, okay, to us, time is still unfolding. To our conscious experience within the framework of time and space, time is still continually unfolding. It's still happening. And we haven't seen that page yet and made our choice. But to God, it's already been done. And we've already made a choice. And God already knows that. So when we say that God knows what we're going to do, how does he know? Because he
already saw it.
Saw it.
Because his perception of time is non-linear or
correct. Correct. Was that?
Anachronistic.
Yeah.
Anachronistic.
Yeah. Well, that explains non-linear.
But I have another question.
Yes.
I heard someone say that probabilistically time exists in a spiral.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I've noticed with my Facebook posts, like when I look on this day, I'll be thinking about the very same things every year, like it rotates around.
So Kabbalah does not believe in static cyclical time where everything just goes back exactly where it was. It kind of goes back in similar positioning, but we hope that it's deeper than before or higher than before. Like it's moving toward a certain destination, but there are certain cycles to time. But the point here is that God stands outside of time, and therefore, even though to us it hasn't happened yet, to God it's already happened, so God knows it not because. So God's knowledge is not compulsion. It doesn't affect us. Doesn't force us to choose that way. It actually is a product of us choosing that way. Okay, now, let's read this, clearly stated by the Tosfot Yom Tov, Rabbi Yom Tov Lipman Heller, and if you know the story of the fellow, oh, such a great story, how do I not tell it? Okay, fine, I will. Text number 10 is by Rabbi Heller. And Rabbi Yom Tov Lipman Heller, so the story goes that he lived in a town, he was a rabbi of a town. And in the town, there was a very wealthy man. And this wealthy man was known to not give a penny to tzedakah. In fact, people were so heartbroken by this fellow's insistence on not giving that they shunned him, they disliked him. And when he died, they said, he's not going to be buried in the Jewish cemetery. Or he'll be buried at the edge. I could not bury him in the cemetery, but all the way at the edge, away from everyone else. Because he was not part of the community. So what, he should be buried with the community? He's buried, he cut himself off, let him stay cut off. The first Friday after this fellow passed away, the rabbi gets a knock on the door. Family asking for some money, for some provisions for Shabbat. Okay, he has a fund, he gives some money. Next one, money. Yep. Where are all these people coming from? He says, what happened up until now? Why suddenly this week? We don't know. Every Thursday night, between Thursday night and Friday morning, we used to get mysterious gifts of food and money on our door. It wasn't long before Rabbi Heller put two and two together and said to himself, this fellow who died and everyone, no one thought that he gave, he was really secretly supporting the whole community. And no one knew about it. So he said, you don't dig up somebody and move there. He said, when I die, bury me next to this guy. And indeed, he's buried next to this guy.
You can't move a guy?
You don't move. You don't typically move a guy. Sometimes you move a guy, but not usually.
Okay.
Usually you don't disturb the deceased. Yeah. Okay, so that's the story about him. Let's read what he says about the time factor and the fortune teller model. Text number 10. Raphael, please read. So here's the point. Going back to our sports analogy. So we're watching the replay of the Super Bowl together. I've seen it, you haven't. The fact that I know that Nick Foles is going to pull that trick play and score a touchdown, my knowledge did not make that play happen. My knowledge is because I've seen the play, and to me it's in the past, whereas to you, it's the future that is about to unfold. And so here we have two people with two perspectives. One to whom it's the past, and one to whom it's the future. But the very fact that for one person it's new doesn't mean that objectively for everyone it's new. For some, including myself, who've seen it already yesterday live, it's not the future, it's not a blank slate, it's known to be what happened because it's already happened. To God, it's not a blank slate. God knows what happens. God's seen the ending because the ending has already happened to God, not to us. How does that work? Come back to lesson two. You have to listen to the replay. When you listen to the replay, you'll know what Nick Foles did in lesson two. But there was no Nick Foles in lesson two. And then you're wondering, how did I put him in the recording? Okay. Now, let's... Good. Yes, we're good. This is how we can answer the question, fortune teller approach. God is not limited by time. Simple answer. Yes, we like it. It works. Any flaws with the answer? It's ironclad, by the way. This is like a tight answer. This is straight up. Great.
We're
stuck in time, so we don't know what's going to happen. God's not stuck in time. He's already seen it. So God knows because we've already made that choice on some plane of existence that we're not even aware of yet. Yes?
There's still some elements missing.
Which one?
Well,
because the element of are we really free to choose if we are to be essentially one with God? If we're doing it in God's ways, then we are not free to choose. Everything we're doing is as God sees it.
Well, here's the thing. When God sees it, he might also see our mistakes. In other words, a person has a choice between doing the right thing or the wrong thing. Let's say a person chooses in real time to do the wrong thing. God already knew that because God's already seen it. It's not the right choice. It's the wrong choice, but we've already done it. So that's how God knows it. But to us, we have that choice in the moment.
So does then God has the power to swoop in and change it, right?
Yeah.
But does God know what he's going to do?
Does God know what he's going to do?
Yeah.
I would hope. I don't. That's like, can God create a rock that he can't lift?
Oh no!
I don't even know. Can God not know something? That's the question. Can God work himself out of knowing something?
Or the future or the present?
He doesn't.
And change it if he wanted to.
Right.
But
typically, God does not swoop in. You have rare occasions. We call those miracles and like exodus from Egypt and all that stuff. But typically, God doesn't swoop. Okay. Yeah. I guess you could say if God doesn't pull the plug on the whole operation, then God is okay with it continuing to play out as he knows it will. I guess you have to say that. That's a good point. Yeah. I guess even with the sin, God's like, all right, let's keep this thing going. Because you're right, God could have pulled the plug. And if he pulled the plug, it would never have been, as we said in lesson two. Okay, so this is a simple answer. It seems like a solid answer. Here's the problem with this answer. It's so good, it's suspicious. Ah. You like this? This is it. It's so good. It so makes sense. It doesn't make sense. I'll tell you why. If this answer is really as good as it sounds, how come, help me out, how come? This is Mad Libs. Come on, guys. Give me a name of a guy character that we discussed already. How come? Rambam doesn't say this.
He was busy.
Yeah. No. If it's such an easy answer, why doesn't Maimonides say it? And furthermore, who does say this answer? Other than the Tosfos Yom Tov, who was it? The Ravid. Remember the Ravid? How does he introduce it and how does he conclude it? Look back. How does he introduce it and how does he conclude it? I'll give you a text. A text is text number 9. How does he introduce it? There's no conclusive, although there's no conclusive answer, I'm going to give you some sort of answer. Does that sound like a confident fellow?
No.
Does that sound like an ironclad answer? If you and I are thinking this is an ironclad answer, we're obviously missing something. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Yeah.
If this answer seems like, wow, this answers it 100% from all sides, really? How come Rambam didn't answer it? Why is Ravid answering this very tentatively? How does he conclude it? All this, however, is not a worthy explanation. Does that sound like an ironclad answer to you?
Sounds like he's got doubt.
Okay, so the question is, what is missing? Yes.
It's already said.
Yeah.
All is foreseen and free choice is granted.
Okay.
Okay.
Listen, but we moved past that. We moved past that quote.
You're saying how come he didn't bring it to conclusion?
Yeah. No, because the paradox we know both are true. Listen, we know that point one is true, that God knows everything, and number two is also true, that we have free choice. That we know. We're starting with these two premises. Rabbi Akiva states it. This is true, and this is true. The question is, how do they coexist in a world of truth simultaneously? And so, Rambam says, how do they coexist? We don't know. We don't know. We can't know God, so we don't know. So therefore, we believe that this is the case, that although God knows, we have free choice. How does it work? We don't have the mechanics down. That's what Rambam says. Ravid says, I'll tell you how it works. The fortune teller model. The Tosfos Yom Tov says, I'll break it down for you. I'll give it down to you, right? God is outside of time, and we're in time, so we don't know it yet. But God knows it because he's already seen it. So he knows it because we did it. So therefore, free choice is real, and God's knowledge is real, and they can coexist at the same time. My point now is, clearly, this is not a solid, foolproof answer. It's clearly not a foolproof answer. Rambam, Maimonides doesn't cite it, number one. And number two, Ravid, who does cite it, he does so super tentatively. He's very hesitant to cite this answer. He says, look, I have to give you an answer because I'm railing against Rambam Maimonides for raising a question he doesn't answer. The least I can do in pointing that out is offer some sort of answer. So he says, here's some sort of answer, but this is not a solid answer. It's not a worthy explanation. My question is, why is it not worthy? We all nodded, this is great. God's outside of time. So he sees, you know why it's not good? Rambam already told you why it's not good. Remember that preamble that I said seems irrelevant? That was him telling you why he's not going to give that answer. You with me on this? The two questions answer each other? I haven't explained it yet. I'm giving you the construct. I'm giving you the framework. Okay? Rambam, we said, his approach is, we don't understand God's ways. So why did he just say that? Why did he say this whole thing about God and his mind are one, but us and our mind are two? Huh? So therefore, we can't understand God because we have duality, whereas God is oneness. Why? Why say all that stuff? We don't understand God. Finished. We believe it. Maimonides, with that preamble, is telling us why we can't give the fortune teller response. You see, it works with the Super Bowl. It doesn't work with God. I knew what was going to happen because I saw it. And my knowledge later doesn't compel it. You know why? Because my knowledge never made it happen. Who made it happen? Nicholas Foles III. I don't think he's the third. I just felt like I wanted to add that in. Who made it happen? Nicholas J. Foles is the one who made it happen. My knowledge... Whether in real time watching it and being aware of what happened or watching the replay, my knowledge never made it happen because this is how our minds work. You ready? This is what Rambam is telling us, but we kind of missed it. But it's okay. It's okay. Most everyone missed it until the late 1980s when the Rebbe shared this incredible mystical insight. We all would miss it, but here's what it actually means. The mind, according to Rambam, philosophy, and Rambam in this case is pretty much talking Kabbalah, the mind, our minds, are a tool that we use to observe things outside of ourselves. Work with me here. Think of a microscope. The microscope is a tool that's used to observe something outside of itself. The microscope doesn't view itself.
Right.
1 second. So the mind is a tool that observes other things. Right? So there's you, there's your mind, there's your knowledge of something, and there's that thing. And everything is a different piece. There's you, there's your mind, there's the knowledge, there's that thing, all separate pieces. To God, you can't say this. You can't say this about God. I'll tell you why. Very simply. You can't say this about God because you know what that implies? That implies that God didn't know what Nick Foles was going to do. Until Nick Foles did it, and then God learned. What's the problem with that? You have an ever-expanding God. And God now is a composite of information that is being added and added and added. You with me on this? This is the problem. We've now created a composite God where God exists himself, and then others give him more information and more wisdom and more things are happening, so he's aware of more and more and more and more, which means that God is now built up of many different pieces. That is a composite God, and although composite sketches are good in some situations, we don't want a composite God. That's not the God that we believe in. Okay? That's not the God that we believe in. We believe in a one God. So therefore, Rambam writes, and he quotes himself. In Hilchot Shuvah, he quotes himself in Hilchot Yesodei Torah. Right? You saw that? As we've already explained before in chapter 2 of the Laws of the Foundations of Torah. You remember? You with me on this? You understand what I'm saying now? He quotes himself about this mind and God and one and two, and whatever, this duality or singularity. Okay. Why does he quote himself? Because over there in Hilchot Yesodei Torah, the Laws of the Foundation of the Torah, when he talks about God, who is God and what is God, when he establishes the reality of God according to Judaism, he says very clearly that God and God's knowledge, let's talk about God's knowledge. God doesn't know things because they happen. Things happen because he knows them. This is the key point. God does not know things because they happen. Rather, they happen because he knows them. Right. So now, you with me on this? Again, otherwise you would say that God knew. Right? What did Tosfos Yom Tov say? Like, how does God know what we're going to do? Because God is seeing into the future. There's no future. Everything's one, like present, whatever. So God knows what we did. Yeah, that's problematic. That's problematic based on our theology of God. Based on our understanding of God, that is essentially problematic. How do you say that about God? That means that God didn't know what Nick Foles was going to do until Nick Foles did it? God doesn't know what I'm going to do before I do it. So God knows it at, one second, God knows it after I've done it, but God doesn't know before then. That means I'm adding on to God. I'm giving God new information. God, psst, hey, let me tell you what I'm going to do. This is what I'm going to do. And now you know it. I've given something to God. Really? Things don't happen. Sorry, God doesn't know things because they've happened. Things happen because God knows it. In the understanding, using language of Kabbalah, everything exists within God's mind. Imagine you're imagining. Imagine you're daydreaming. Imagine you are conjuring up characters. Where do they exist? In your mind. They exist in your mind. They only exist in your mind. They exist because of your mind. They don't exist. It's not like you know about them because they exist. They exist because you know about them. Yes? That's how it works with God. We all exist in God's imagination. We said in other classes we use the language of projection. We're all projections of God, etc., etc., etc. On the highest levels of understanding God, Maimonides says, you cannot give me, you cannot sell me, you cannot offer me a fortune teller answer. You cannot run that past me. Maimonides is saying, there's a simple answer to the question. Unfortunately, it's not 100% accurate. Because it doesn't address the true reality and the true reality of God. It does not address it. Therefore, what Maimonides is doing is, he's actually building the question. And he's telling you like this. We know, we've been told, the Torah, the foundation of Torah, Torah is predicated on the notion of free choice. He says, and I know what you're thinking. I'm going to reconcile this by saying, yeah, I still have choice even though God knows because God has seen me choose. So he says, you cannot say that. Because we've already explained before in chapter 2 of the laws of foundation of Torah that unlike us whose minds are separate from us, God and his mind are one. Which means that God knows from the inside out, not from the outside in. God doesn't know things because they've happened. Things happen. This is the fourth time I'm saying this. Consciously I'm saying it four times. I could say it five also. Right? Things don't happen. God doesn't know things because they've happened. Things happen because God knows them. Everything exists within the mind and the imagination of God. Therefore, he says, we cannot answer this question. Maimonides, what is he doing? What is his objective? His objective is simply raising the question, illuminating to us the extent of the question. Ravid understands this. His issue with Rambam is not that Rambam is wrong. He understands what Rambam did. He understands what Maimonides did. He gets it. Maimonides took a question of how do you reconcile knowledge and choice, and by an easy answer, because knowledge is not compulsion. So therefore, there's no contradiction to begin with. Who said knowledge means that you have to do something? Knowledge is knowledge, and choice and compulsion is choice and compulsion. Two different things. Rambam took it and said, you can't answer that, because God's knowledge is compulsion. God makes things by knowing things. So now what?
Now we got nothing.
So 1 second. So Ravid says, I understand you, Rambam. I got it. Why are you doing this? You're right. You're right that it's an unanswerable question. And you're right to brilliantly show us how these other answers are not accurate. But why are you doing it? To show us that the question is unanswerable? You're still creating doubt in the mind of the reader. You're still creating doubt in the minds of people that otherwise would have simple faith, and now they're confused. So he says, therefore, I'm going to begrudgingly offer the answer that Rambam doesn't like, and now I also don't like it. But I have to give you something. But that's why he says it's not a full answer. Turns out that they're both right. Ravid is right, this is an answer. He's also right that it's not an answer. Rambam is right that there's no answer. They're all right. It depends on what you're talking about. Depends on which perspective we're using. Remember we had a session, I think it was lesson one. It was about Dat Elyon and Dat Tachton, higher perception and lower perception. Higher perspective. Right. From our perspective, we exist. We don't know God, right? God is the unknown. But we know us, I know I exist. The best I can say is that there's a creator, but I really don't know how this all happens. It's something from nothing. What's the source? Nothing. I have no idea what the source is, but I know that I exist. That's our perception. What's God's perception? That God is, that God's the is, and we were the not. Right? Something from nothing. Either we're something from nothing. God says, I'm something. All y'all are nothing because you exist in my mind. Maimonides was speaking about from the perspective of Dat Elyon. From that perspective, from the perspective that God is everything, you can't answer this question. You can't answer the question. From the perspective that God is everything, everything exists within the mind of God, right? Nothing has independent existence. If that's the case, so how do we have free choice? The answer is, we believe that this is so. The Torah tells us. Torah tells us, choose life. We have the choice. How does it make sense? I have no idea. From Dat Elyon, from Maimonides is lifting us up. Look at reality from the highest vantage point. From the God's eye perspective. From God's perspective. From God's perspective. Are you with me on this? Sort of? Yes-ish? Yes. From the highest perspective of reality. From the perspective that says, from God's perspective, that God says, I exist. You don't have your own independent existence. You just exist within me. From that perspective, that God knows and therefore it is, from that perspective, how's your free choice? Maimonides says, we believe it. It's an article of faith. Ravid says, and the Tosfos Yom Tov say, so let's look at things instead, because that's unanswerable. Let's look at reality instead from our vantage point. Not God's vantage point. Not the ultimate vantage point, but our vantage point. Which, by the way, is also true, because God created us with this vantage point, so it's also a true vantage point. Our vantage point is, we exist. We exist distinct from God. Now, God will acknowledge that God started us off, that God's our creator, but we exist on our own. We don't exist with them. You woke up this morning and said, I exist in the mind of God? Or you said, you exist? I said, I exist. I need to eat. I need to do this. I need to do that. I need all these things. I exist. Right? From God's perspective, we don't really exist. Only God exists, and we exist in God's mind. And from that level, we have free choice? Who knows? How do we even exist? Who knows? Right? Just within God's mind. But from the lower perspective, that tachton, our vantage point is, I exist. I'm real. I exist outside of God. God started me, but now I exist outside of God. Now, from that perspective, we can give the answer that we gave, the Tosfos Yom Tov's answer. From that perspective, we can say, look, we exist. We are real. The choices we make are real. And God knows what this separate entity, i.e. us, God knows what we're going to choose because he's seen it already. But now we're talking about two separate things, God and us, because of separateness. So again, both perspectives are true. From the higher perspective, there's no answer. From the lower perspective, there is an answer. Yes? Yes?
I don't mind being
Yes. Hold on. Yeah.
So is the Rambam saying that God started it all with an idea, with a thought, with a word, with a just exist, and then we existed. And then since we are part of God, we are God. But he creates the world in every second, and we do have the choice to grow this planet and grow this flower or kill it, so that he knows what we're doing because we are him. We are his mind, his or its mind.
No, what Rambam is saying is that nothing exists without him knowing it into existence. Which means that he is knowing, compelling things into existence. He's creating everything. Which then begs the question, so what do we do? And his answer is, I have no idea. But I know that, his answer is, we can't know this, but you have to believe that it's true, nonetheless. It doesn't make sense, and still believe it. Rambam says, at the end of the day, we do have free choice. But how to understand it, he says, we don't know. We can't understand this one. Because by all indications, we shouldn't have free choice. Sorry, yeah.
So maybe the free choice at the end is that we are blocked. God is giving us free choice by blocking our memory and blocking our knowledge.
That's a good answer. He doesn't say that answer. If that was the answer, he would have said it. He doesn't say it. He sets up, it's a fine answer. you could take a simple answer. You could say we are compelled, but God makes us unaware of that compulsion, which is, I think, what you're saying. In other words, free choice is not real. It's an illusion. God implants within us a seed of illusion that we actually have free choice. And that's fine. You could say that. But Rambam doesn't say that. So we're trying to understand Rambam. Rambam is saying that we are all compelled, basically, because we're all being created every moment. We're all being imagined by God at every moment. Everything about everything is being imagined at this moment. So how's free choice? He says, we don't know. All we know, let's read inside. He says, therefore, we lack the capacity to know the nature of God's knowledge of all his creations and actions. But this we know without a doubt, that the deeds of man are in the hands of man, and God does not induce or coerce a person to do anything. How's that possible? We don't know. He's not answering the question. He's stating the fact. He's literally leaving it as a question, but saying both are true. How? Who knows? He doesn't give that answer that free choice is an illusion. It's not real.
Right. But God does say we have the power to create or destroy. We can kill or we can grow.
Correct. Correct. How do you reconcile, again, all of that is true. How do you reconcile that with the fact that our creation destruction is being imagined at that moment by God, and without God's imagining it, we can't do it? So now what? So how does that work? It raises a whole host of questions. Fine. So we don't have an answer to that. But the point is that Rambam is elevating us to a higher vantage point from which this question begins to be a real question, as opposed to from the lower vantage point where we're separate from God anyway. So if we're separate from God, again, not that we're not created by God, but we're at this point, we're distinct from God. From this level of distinction, we can say that, look, we make all the choices. And God's seen all the choices. God's outside of that. We're distinct, right? God's up there. We're down here. Down here we do it. God's seen it. God's seen it already. And therefore, he knows it. And that's the answer. Makes sense? Everything makes sense? Yes? Two perspectives. Rambam, Ravid. Two different perspectives. Higher, lower. Good. Now we get to the real point of the class.
Or so we thought.
And by the way, I'm serious. I'm serious. Here's the real point of the class. What is choice? I'm about to demonstrate that everything you know about choice is wrong. Everything you know about the word choice is wrong. And I'm going to give you a simple ice cream example. You walk into an ice cream shop. Two shops, two scenarios. Scenario number one, you walk into an ice cream shop and they have 31 flavors. You can choose whatever flavor you want. Any flavor. Second scenario, there's a second ice cream shop that has one flavor, just one flavor. Now my question is, in which scenario, which shop do you have a choice?
Both. Yeah. Absolutely both.
You don't have to get that ice cream.
Yeah, all right. Which shop do you really have? One second. Which shop do you really have a choice? You would think, right? Thank you for helping me out here. We got to move it along. We got to keep this snappy, right? So again, all of us would say, if this wasn't a Kabbalistic trick question, right? We would all say that, yeah, the one with 31 choices, the 31 flavors gives me choices, give me options. The one with one does not give me any options. Now I have the option not to get it, but if I'm getting it, then there's only one option, and that doesn't sound like much of a choice. Now let me give you another scenario. Let me add another wrinkle to the scenario. You see, here's the deal. Here's what I didn't tell you about me. I only like chocolate ice cream. And what I also didn't tell you is that the first store that only has, that not only, that has 31 flavors does not have chocolate. And the second store that only has one flavor only had chocolate. And now let me ask the question again. In which store am I able to choose? It depends on how you define choice. If you define choice as the ability to select between more than one option, so which store has choice? 31 flavors. If we define choice as the ability to assert self and to express how we feel about something, what we want, what we truly desire, where did I exercise my choice?
Number two.
You see, here's the thing. Kabbalah teaches that the truest moments of choice is where there's really no other option. And you think in those moments when there are no other options, oy vey, I don't have any choices, I'm not choosing, it's compelled. Not so fast. If that's your choice, because that's your choice, you don't need any other options. Right? You're on The Bachelor or The Bachelorette, and you have 20 odd, I don't mean odd people, I mean 20...
Story.
Ah, how did I fall into that? Because I did it intentionally. Right, you have 20-odd people that are vying for the one person's attention. Right? Yeah, there's a choice. There's a choice. What if there's no one that's your soulmate? Is it still a choice? Let's say you meet your soulmate. Right? So somebody says, I met my soulmate. Oh, my! I'm in love. I've met my soulmate. This is it. He or she is the one. That's it. So somebody says, well, you need choices. You need more people. You need to choose from. Why do I need to choose? I've already chosen. Yeah, but you didn't choose more than, you didn't have a lineup. You didn't choose. Oh, no, I chose. I chose. Because choice really means an assertion, self-assertion, assertion of self. Choice really means living authentically to who you are and choosing your inherent, essential, inner path. And when you're in touch with who you are, there's only one choice. So it turns out that you and I, even on a lower level, can experience God's level of choice. Sorry for mixing everyone up here. Even in our lower experience, we have the ability to experience choice in a way that there's no other choice, that things are almost compelled. You see, your essence is one. Your essence is what it is, and it's not anything else. From your living by your essence and from your essence, you are compelled to choose. You're compelled, but not from an outside source. That's not considered true compulsion. See, we call compulsion somebody else twisted my arm. Someone else forced my hand. But if I'm forced by myself, that's not being forced. That's being truly expressive. That is truly choosing. Kabbalah teaches the truest choice is when you are so sure about your choice that there's really no other choice. When you walk into the ice cream store that now has 32 flavors, including chocolate, how many options are there? There's one option. There's still one option. Aye, what about the choice? You see, we like options because typically in dat tachton, the lower perspective, we need options until we figure out what it is we want because we work even for ourselves from the outside in sometimes. But if you're operating from the inside out, if you're truly in touch with who you are, you don't need options. There's only one choice. And so here's the point. Here's the point. We have a choice. The choice is what type of choice? Our choice is which definition of choice we're going to live by. Are we going to live life from a place where there are so many choices because we don't know who we are? And therefore, choice to us will be defined by this dizzying array of options that we will be conflicted about? Or will we live true to self and define choice for us as authentically asserting who we are every single time? This is the choice that we have. Not between right and wrong, but between how we define choice for ourselves. Thank you very much for joining me for this 6-week series, this experience of what is. It's been a great journey, and I couldn't have done it without you.